Pastors who use the lectionary to inform their preaching throughout the church year constantly encounter the juxtaposition between Advent, the coming of Christ, God with us in the flesh, and the parousia, or the return of Christ in his final coming. It's like we try to raise Jesus from the dead before ever celebrating his birthday. But in our Christological and historical faith tradition, the two are more closely linked than we care to think about. Advent is theologically yoked to the return of Jesus and to the completion of the entire human story, a story that is growing ever more vulnerable these days. United Methodist Bishop Lowry confesses that he is uncomfortable with this pairing and struggles with its implication for faith, witness, and proclamation. Yet this insistence is built into the most basic affirmation we make in the communion liturgy each week. At the culmination of the Great Thanksgiving is the adamant confession: Christ has died, Christ has risen, Christ is coming again. Karl Barth even said, "We can't fathom the second advent of Jesus Christ, and we stammer when we try to speak of it." It is true that most of us enter the season of Advent not quite ready to replace our pumpkins with lights and snowmen. Many of us have just eaten stuffed turkeys and pumpkin pies and are probably still eating leftover turkey sandwiches at mealtime. Although we have little interest in delving into the eschatological presuppositions that accompany this historical journey, this season of Advent calls us to look more closely into the depths of our theological heritage and at the trajectory of the unscripted between time occurring between these two holy Advents and how it will impact our future. A future, for many of us, that feels like it's hanging in the balance, the kind of shift unknown to Western society in over 70 years. A kind of future that Andrew Sullivan predicted in the May edition of New York Magazine will be a breeding ground for tyranny. In Marilynne Robinson's novel, Gilead, the Reverend John Ames observes that you never do know the actual nature, even of your own experience, much less that of others. In her new essay collection, When I Was a Child, I Read Books, Robinson applies the idea with rigor. There is sacred mystery with every individual experience, every life, she says. In view of that mystery, we must forget definition, forget assumption, and watch. And watch we must. The season of Advent reminds the Christian church of our shared and lived experience and our relationship as the church to time and space and to our duty to uphold that relationship. As a deeply rooted Judaic-born religion, ours is a story that depends on the historical narrative to guide our place in both the present, the past, and to make sense of this in-between time. But ours is also a story full of paradox, always pointing us towards anticipated futures, bookended in hope, justice, and love, but infused with endless wrong turns, shortcomings, and failures, befalling even the greatest, noblest, most faithful, most prepared among us. Our story begins with the birth of creation in a timeless and formless place, but ends in a judgment under the scrutiny of a divine and extremely ordered way of life, shaped in part by the God of creation and in part by the gods who rule creation. As we enter this ordered and hopeful season of the church year, some of us hoping to forget and others yearning, watching for what is yet to come, we are confronted with an aberrant need for preparation, desperately seeking all avenues whereby we might be catapulted into a ready-made major of grace. We are desperate to make room for the Christ child to enter in, while the walls of an assumed and sane order seem to be crashing down upon us, one tweet, one post, one newspaper article, one vote at a time. Meanwhile, as we dare to begin an Advent journey of self-reflection, of honest introspection, we must commit ourselves to the work of creating a safe place not only for the refugee soon to be born in the manger, but for those most unknown to us. We are not called to be halted by fear's roaring head or paralyzed by our own exposed identities, but to carry on grinding meal in the field, making room, cleaning out space, setting the table, preparing the way for the advent of light to enter into our human story once again. And in so doing, we are reminded of these two governing gods. One God, capital G, the ruler of light on whom all life depends, who enters our story each and every year, that we might truly know life and find peace in the light of one another. And contrary to the creator God who brings light, the small g gods, those among us so acquainted with darkness that rather than hear this eschatological call to readiness as preparation for the freedom of peace and justice that will come in Jesus, they are blinded by a fear so deep that would render them outside of the boat, under the ship sinking, unprepared, not ready, drowning in darkness. And so rather than turn towards the light, there is a surge of resistance that instead is fueled by the gluttony of revenge, of the elemental human need for acceptance and security, and ultimately for power, thus giving themselves, as in the days of Noah, to a deceptive cause, one camouflaged with greatness that will lead them and others who choose to follow straight to a spiraling death. In Matthew's text, this Jesus reminds his followers that nobody knows, not the angels, not Jesus himself, but God alone, the day and hour of love's fulfillment. There's really no question today as to the nature or relevancy of this text to a modern-day listener seeking for a word of wisdom, of comfort, amidst all the impossibilities that seem to surround us on all sides. To the church, to all of God's people, I think the message is loud and clear. Listen. Listen. Closely. Love more intensely. Be less attached to stuff and more attached to people. Form less lines and more relationships. Hold hands and open doors for others in public spaces. And smile. Even when you don't know whether or not it will be welcomed by another. And show up. Stand up. Be prepared. Fight for the same justice that for 33 years Jesus gave his life. Make room for light to come in and turn upside down every abomination handed down to us in darkness by the little g gods that have risen to power. And in the face of the evils of this day, when most Americans are saying, "This is not my America. This is not our America," agree with them and then work to change it. And how do we change it? Included in the latest publication of The New Yorker is an article entitled Aftermath, 16 Writers on Trump's America. One of the contributors was Juno Diaz, a Pulitzer Prize-winning Dominican-American writer, creative writing professor at MIT. In this article, he is responding to his godchildren, who all year have been having nightmares about their parents being deported. So what now, he writes. Well, first and foremost, we need to feel. We need to connect courageously with the rejection, the fear, the vulnerability that this victory has inflicted on us, without turning away or numbing ourselves or lapsing into cynicism. We need to bear witness to what we have lost, our safety, our sense of belonging, our vision for our country. We need to mourn all these injuries so that they do not drag us into despair, so repair can be possible. And while we're doing the hard, necessary work of mourning, we should avail ourselves to the old formations that have seen us through darkness. We organize. We form solidarities. And yes, we fight. To be heard, to be safe, to be free. But all the fighting in the world will not help us if we do not also hope. What I'm trying to cultivate is not blind optimism, wrote Diaz, but what the philosopher Jonathan Lear calls radical hope. And what makes this hope radical, Lear writes, is that it is directed toward a future goodness that transcends our current ability to understand it. Radical hope is not something that we do or just have, but it's something that we practice over and over again. It demands flexibility and openness and what Lear describes as imaginative excellence. Imaginative excellence. Radical hope is our best weapon against despair, even when despair seems justifiable. It makes the survival of the end of your world possible. And only radical hope, said Diaz, could have imagined people like us into existence. And I believe that it will help us to create a better, more loving future. And whether Lear sees himself as a modern prophet or not, his words could not more closely be aligned with the sacred movement of our ecclesial story at this time and place. Preparing for the advent of God's redemptive light into an age-old story where floods come and floods go, requires a deep remembrance, an imaginative excellence that makes channeling this lived experience of radical hope palpable and possible, even when our despair threatens to swallow us whole. This radical hope will soon be born among us and reborn within us. And because we know how our story ends, and because we know this Jesus, this rabbi, this rebel by whom the world will both fall and rise, we also know that sometimes radical hope means choosing to believe in a goodness that transcends our current ability to understand it. Now, almost immediately, when I was thinking about Lear's work and reading through one of his books, I started thinking about how we might envision our own response to this Advent call of imaginative excellence. I was reminded of one of the students that I was so fortunate enough to work with during my time at United Church of Chapel Hill, and her name was Sophie Steiner. Sophie was one of those kids who just embodied imaginative excellence. Far beyond her years, she understood what it meant to not only watch for and anticipate goodness, but what it meant to choose goodness, even in the face of the most overwhelming despair, to dream of a reality where goodness transcends our current ability to understand it. Sophie wrote a poem her freshman year of high school, 5 days before she was diagnosed with a cancer that became terminal for her. And she included this poem in her blog. The blog is called Walk On. And I want to share this poem with you today. It's entitled, "But You and I Are Really Just the Same." Sophie Steiner. I would get on a bus for human rights, so that every person can live with no abuse or violence, so that girls can live with no harm, that boys can share the wealth, so that every human is equal and no one is at a loss. I would get on a bus and travel. I will stand on my own 2 feet and I will support myself. If no one else does, I will get on a bus for human rights. Hunger carves in a hole in two opposite people, the people of power, of gold, and of wealth, and the people of nothing, nothing to live for, no food or water. People talk and talk about changing. What are they going to change? Travel and listen. Don't sit and talk. I would get on a bus for human rights so that every human can live without a hole of hunger. I would get on a bus for human rights because the empty dark hole needs to be filled with light and music and art so that every word can be heard and no one is ignored. And there is no empty hole. Everyone talks, but no one does. Will you? God, in your mercy, shine your light upon this, your Advent people. Amen.